you, Sam. I appreciate that. It's great to be here again. Last time we did this, it was just the most powerful thing. Not necessarily for what we said, but some of the stories from the floor were just really moving and powerful. And hopefully we can kind of replicate that this time. If possible, no pressure. Anyway, I was thinking about we maybe do a little bit of introductions for those of us who don't know us. Forgive us if you've heard this before, but we figured 5 or 6 minute introductions each. We'd kind of talk about what we've been doing over the course of the year, and then some of larger questions, maybe we can introduce some of those and then kind of open it up to the floor and we can just kind of talk about stuff. Because, I mean, it really is a unique opportunity for two veterans to come together and have a space where they can talk about, you know, why they joined the military, why they decided to leave the military, and kind of look at that whole experience through with a hypercritical lens. And we are really appreciative of this space, and we wish there was more of these types of spaces out there, and hopefully one day there will be. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Rory Fanning. And I think starting at 9/11 is a good place to start. I signed up right after college. I saw those planes hitting the Twin Towers, and I, you know, didn't necessarily have a worldview at that point. I was just kind of taking life as it came at me, and I said I want to do my part to prevent another 9/11. So I decided I was going to sign up for the military. I had a sense back then that when you sign up for the military, you're kind of less of a human being and more of a piece of equipment once you're actually in. And I wanted to become the most expensive piece of equipment possible in the shortest amount of time. So I decided I'd sign up for the U.S. Army Rangers. U.S. Army Rangers kind of specialize in taking airports and providing backup and support for Navy SEALs and Delta Force. Training was hard, but mostly boring. I think the main point of the training in Ranger Regiment, which included a lot of food and sleep deprivation, was just getting used to saying yes. In the military, they don't want critical thinkers. They don't want people thinking for themselves. They just want you to follow orders. And I think that was the point of all of our training in the Ranger Regiment. And after, I think, about 6 months, I found myself getting ready to go to Afghanistan. And when we landed in Afghanistan, it was the middle of the night. I was actually expecting bullets to be whizzing by my head as we landed. But it was very quiet when we landed. This was in 2002, in January. This is a few months after the Taliban had surrendered. If you want to learn a little bit more about that, there's a great book whose author is here. It's No Good Men Among the Living. Everybody should check that out, Anand Gopal. And that kind of details what was happening after the immediate invasion. So when I got there the next morning, I was immediately struck by the level of poverty in Afghanistan. I remember going out on a mission and seeing this one woman digging up this scrub brush. And we got back a few hours later and this woman was still digging that up. And I asked her translator, I was like, what is this woman doing? And they said, oh, that woman's there every single day. She's digging up those branches. And that's how she provides her cooking food every single day for her family. And we saw Russian tanks and fighter planes littering the landscape. You know, as people know, Afghanistan was embroiled in a civil war with Russia, and then there was a civil war, and then the U.S. Didn't let them have a breather and kind of came in 2002. And we were seeing the remnants of all of that. The poverty was just overwhelming. And we were out there kind of declaring ourselves there in the military, in the country. The Taliban, like I said, had surrendered, and our job was to bring the Taliban back into the fight. Because as I know now, it's kind of hard to justify, you know, $1 trillion a year Cold War era defense, but quote unquote defense budgets when there isn't an enemy in sight. So we wanted to bring them back into the fight. I think that was what our mission was. So we decided we're gonna occupy a school because that was a forward operating base, and We would see military age guys not show proper level of deference as they walked by this school, you know, where the kids would say, why are we closing schools? And how long is this going to be closed for? And we would say, for as long as we want to occupy your school, essentially. And we would take these teenage boys and put them in one room and another in another room. And one guy would hear a gunshot, and we'd go into the other room and say, is there anything you'd like to tell us? And that guy thinking that his friend had just been killed, and he was certainly tortured. You know, I signed up for the military to prevent another 9/11, and I was seeing that I was only making the world more dangerous because I was bringing people into this fight who I actually didn't even know where the Twin Towers were at the time. But yeah, and I think the numbers bear that out. Between 1981 and 2002, there were 383 suicide bombs around the world, but between 2001 and 2012, there was 2,200 suicide bombs around the world, and I think that is a direct result of our occupations. And as we know, the majority of the people that have died since 9/11 have been innocent civilians. I think that the number is at least 80%. And so I decided that I couldn't have any more to do with this. I was nothing more than a bully in one of the most impoverished places in the world, and I decided I was going to become a war resister. And I don't necessarily like the word conscientious objector because it kind of implies religious kind of motivations for it. And to a degree, there was something along those lines with me at the time. But this was more a question of right and wrong, of just and unjust, and actually recognizing the fact that I was making the world a more dangerous place. So I decided to become one of the first, I think probably the first U.S. Army Ranger to become a war resister after 9/11. I was immediately kind of put as the outcast within the Ranger Regiment, was assigned to bake cakes and wash dishes and absorb the general ridicule of my chain of command for about 6 months while they figured out what to do with me, because it was kind of a rare thing to have a Ranger become a war resister at that time. And I really wasn't, I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I was expecting to go to jail, or back to the big army is what they called it, to be a bullet stopper. The Rangers like to call people in the big army bullet stoppers. And I thought that's what my fate was. But there was one person that stuck with me throughout that entire time, and his name was Pat Tillman and his brother Kevin Tillman. First time I met Pat Tillman, he was in a coffee shop. It was after a training exercise. Everyone else was out drinking, and he had just written a paper on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that he was exchanging with his brother while drinking coffee while everybody else was out getting drunk. And this guy was just immediately mind-blowing. And he was really, really appreciative of what I was doing, and I was surprised by that. You know, he liked people who were critical thinkers. He liked people that were standing up for what they believed in, and he said, you know, if I was in a different situation, because he too was growing disgruntled with what was happening in Afghanistan and Iraq, he said I might do the same thing. So we had a bit of a relationship, and particularly I really bonded with his brother Kevin at the time. So after about 6 months, I get a call down to formation, and I'm told that, you know, Rory, I think this is the day I'm going to jail, but I was told that Pat Tillman was killed the day before in Afghanistan. He died a hero and fighting the enemy in an enemy ambush. I was immediately overwhelmed and mind blown and didn't know what to do because this guy was a bit of a rock for me in one of the most difficult times of my life. But I was immediately ushered out of the military for some reason. I was like, why are they sending me out of the military? I literally was gone within 7 days. I went back to Chicago, found out a few months later that the military was covering up the death of Pat Tillman, go all the way up to the highest levels of the government. At the very least, you know, Dick Cheney, George Bush, they all were covering up the death of their poster boy for the war on terror. You know, if Pat Tillman could sign up for the military, everybody could sign up for the military. And no, we did not kill our own guy. But in fact, that's exactly what happened. Came from a pretty right-wing Catholic family. I was very scared to talk about why I became a war resister to my family. I kind of closed off part of myself for a long time afterwards. Was tired of living like half of a person for the 5 years after I left the military, and I decided to shake things up, and I decided I was going to walk across the United States for the Pat Tillman Foundation and raise the $3.6 million that he gave up. It was an amazing experience walking across the country. So many really great experiences. You know, sleeping behind Walmarts and Targets, and but 50 people across the country invited me into their house. It was really, really amazing. But after finishing that walk across the country, I still didn't feel like a full person. So I decided to retrace my steps via history books when I got home, and I wrote a book about my experience. But this time, I was very conscious of the fact that I walked where Nat Turner had a slave uprising. I walked where Ida B. Wells wrote her anti-lynching papers, and Dolores Huerta organized farm workers. And the San Patricio Battalion said, you know what, we relate more to the Mexicans during the Mexican-American War than we do the U.S. generals, so we're actually going to resist, and they were all hung. And I wrote about those stories as I walked and incorporated this into this book that I wrote. Four years ago, and I've since been talking to high schools and colleges and really kind of opening up about my time in the military and meeting really tremendous people like Spencer, you know, getting linked up with groups like Veterans for Peace and About Face, ISO before kind of crumbled, and now I'm in DSA Veteran Working Group, and just trying to incorporate, you know, these ideas of, you know, anti-imperialism, you know, anti-regime change, but also standing with workers and exploited no matter where they are all around the world. So that's sorry for the long introduction, but that's where I am. This is Spencer. He's going to give you a little bit of a story about him.
So notice, I just like to start off saying Rory is anti-regime change. I'm anti-regime change. I think most of us here are anti-regime change. So contrary to a popular article being circulated today, I think we're all pretty much on the same page here. But anyway, let's do this one more time. I've told this story before, but I have a little bit more distance from it after a year, so I'm happy to tell it one more time. But I'll try to give the Cliff Notes version of it so we could dive into our talk that we have today scheduled. So as a teenager, much like Rory, I was also eating from the trash can of ideology and patriotism. So I got really interested in the idea of serving my country, you know, going to combat, being a war hero, all of that. So initially, I thought, hey, college is expensive. West Point seems like a good idea. Maybe I should apply there. So I applied, got the congressional nomination, but didn't get appointed, didn't get accepted. So I figured I'd enlist, do my time there, get some service under my belt, and just kind of take it as it comes, see what happens. So in May of 2010, the end of my senior year of high school, I enlisted. I was shipped off to what's known as One Station Unit Training in September of that same year as an infantryman. Finished that. During the course of that, I got offered to go to the Rangers, much like Rory, so I figured why not? If I'm in, I might as well try to be the best. So I went through airborne school, went through Ranger selection, get to Ranger Regiment in May of 2011, and I found myself in Afghanistan 2 months later, specifically Khost Province on the eastern part of the country, right on the Pakistani border. Similarly to Rory, I soon found myself not among a group of men who are interested in protecting their loved ones, but instead those who were interested in the idea of killing others with impunity. Now, at the time, I didn't really have much of a political education or any sort of political or class consciousness, but I did, I think, had something of a moral compass, which led me to believe that this wasn't right, what these people were saying about Afghans, how they viewed Afghanistan, and how they viewed the relationship to violence, power, and authority, for that matter. So I wasn't in Afghanistan for too long. Ranger deployments are typically nowadays 3 to 4 months. I got over there mid-rotator halfway, did my time, but I was there long enough to see violence inflicted on the local populations, both explicit and implicit. I was an assistant machine gunner who had to carry the rounds, all the equipment for my team leader, so I was fortunate not having to pull a trigger on any human being. However, I aided and abetted those who did pull triggers on other human beings. And I soon found that even if we didn't fire a single shot there, that just the mere presence of an occupying force is in and of itself violent. It is a presence, a force of violence. And it has very real material psychological effects on, on those who live in such military occupied zones. So while overseas, I decided that I did not agree with the philosophy of my leadership, which inevitably trickles down to the lower ranking leaders such as team leaders, squad leaders, and the like. And I decided maybe if I were to become an officer that I could change things from the inside. So I applied to West Point now as an enlisted man with combat experience, and that looks very appealing on one's application to get into a service academy. So this time around I got in quite easily. Now interestingly enough, to speak to the kind of death cult-like status of the Ranger Regiment, at this time, I mean, I would talk back to some of my team leaders, I'd mouth off here and there, but I wasn't really saying anything too socialist or anti-imperialist. I just thought that their relationship to power was wrong and inequitable. But even having that little bit of opposition to them leads to one becoming a pariah in that unit and being ostracized socially. So the mere fact that I was trying to become an officer and just leave them behind was seen as completely outside the pale. So, in July of 2012, I arrived at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and unfortunately, I soon found that many of the issues I noted in my time in the Ranger Regiment were prevalent at West Point, which was quite jarring, just given the fact that this is supposed to not only be a military institution, but also an academic institution. So what I did is I threw myself into my studies as best as I could. And I happened to be assigned for my freshman year, my world history course, the region. The regional focus was the Middle East. So I really threw myself into the study of the Middle East, specifically learning about things such as the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Balfour Declaration, the partition of Palestine in 1947, and seeing how the United States, after the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, which we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary of, how the U.S. inherited the colonialist mantle of the British and the French before it, and has, if not explicitly been at the forefront of some of these colonialist actions, have been at the periphery enabling them, which of course persists in varying ways today. So I got to my second year, which is when you have to declare if you're going to remain at West Point or leave. And if you leave before your junior year, you can kind of just, go home and do what you want to do. But if you stay after your second year and you decide to leave, well, then you would owe the government some percentage of how much time you spent there. So, for example, if I were to stay 3 years and leave, I'd owe them those 3 years, four, and so on and so forth. And around that time is when I started to realize that I was something of a socialist. In addition to my study of history, I also started to read different socialist theorists, Marx, Lenin, particularly Gramsci, which again, it was really my engagement with history which has always allowed me to best understand socialist theory and anti-imperialism and the like. So I kind of was stuck and I thought, well, after affirming, which was the process of staying at West Point, when I fully realized what my political orientation was, I had options of either risk being thrown back into the enlisted ranks and going through what I went through before, or just sticking it out and trying to, make the best of the situation I was in. And so, on some level, one kind of lies to themselves and they're doing something like that because I knew well enough what, the role of the United States Army was on the global stage. So I get through my time at the academy, and I had a couple close calls here and there with talking back to high-ranking officers and the like, but I graduated in May of 2016, and then later that year is when the Colin Kaepernick protest starts. Rory himself took a picture of himself in his old battle dress uniform blouse at Wrigley Field, saying "Vets for Kaepernick." And now keep in mind, it wasn't until a year later that I decided to go public myself, but that planted the seed. So, I do my time in infantry officer basic course. Somehow I found myself in the infantry again. And being at Fort Benning that second time around was a completely different relationship, though, because I saw a lot of young men, and now women this time around, with shaved heads being shipped off to deploy to Afghanistan again. Around this time, I started to read books such as Rory's, as well as others, and revisiting certain classic anti-war texts by authors such as Stan Goff. And being at Fort Benning especially was jarring just because this is where it all started for me. And I was able to see things that weren't as clear to me when I was 18 and 19 years old at that base. So I finished my time there. I get assigned to Fort Drum, New York, the 10th Mountain Division. And while I was there, talks of deployment came on the horizon again. And actually, the brigade I was in, the 2nd Brigade Combat Team, is just returning from a deployment, I think, in a month. So if I wouldn't have gone out, I would have found myself back in Afghanistan. This time, not only as a soldier, but someone ordering soldiers to, murder Afghans. So in September of 2017, once again, the national anthem debates started happening with, Colin Kaepernick front and center. This time around, Trump is president. And I remember what Rory did, so I found an opening. I, of course, went online, posted the pictures that everyone knows about, and immediately faced the blowback and repression from my chain of command. The picture, of course, said communism will win in my hat. With the hashtag veteran for Kaepernick, of course. So I was under investigation for nearly a year. It was more like 9 months or so. I received two different general officer memorandum of reprimands, one with relation to my public statements condemning President Trump, figures like General Mattis, and so on, but also for advocating for military labor unions, because again, history for me has always been the key to the future and a radical horizon, and I look to the example of Andy Stapp and the American Servicemen's Union towards the latter part of the Vietnam War as a means of kind of, expanding our revolutionary horizons and maybe radicalizing some soldiers along the way. But that also, elicited a negative reaction from my chain of command. And so around February of 2018, I know it's surprising, huh? Around February of 2018, I decide that my best bet is just trying to get out ASAP, because that's what I wanted to do, and it seemed like I finally had the actual administrative ability to do that. So my trial defense attorney, which is the military-provided legal defense for you, he recommended I submit my resignation, which I did, with the caveat that I received nothing less than a general under honorable conditions discharge, which is like the medium discharge. My chain of command, the Department of the Army told me to pound sand, more or less. And so then in April is when I got that kick back, and over the next couple months I kind of thought it over, and I submitted my unconditional resignation, which was accepted pretty readily, and I received an other than honorable discharge in June of 2018, and then I found myself out of the Army. Of course, by that time I really didn't care what the Empire thought was honorable or not, because I realized that they were completely immoral and unethical by any one's worldview. Religious, non-religious, what have you. So, I found myself out of the military. I came into this talk last year. Since then, I've been in graduate school trying to steep myself in social service, but also still an active member of the DSA Veterans Working Group. I'm a member of About Face, Veterans Against the War. Trying to use my position to help fight against endless war, but also taking some time to think and reflect and find myself in all of this, which leads us to today's talk. So.
So the title of this talk is Your Commander-in-Chief is Lying to You. And that came from an article that Spencer and I wrote in early November of 2018. And this was when Trump was deploying or calling up the National Guard, encouraging the National Guard to go to the border to, quote unquote, defend against migrants coming up across the border. And Spencer and I talked a lot about this. We were outraged by this. And, we wanted to do our part to encourage active duty soldiers to resist Trump's orders. So we wrote this piece. It was published in The Nation. It was actually printed, 10,000 copies were printed and kind of distributed at the border. Maybe Spencer can talk a little bit about what was actually in the article.
So, the way we just tried to frame it The opening line being, of course, your commander-in-chief is lying to you, is, you know, not to see, at the time, the migrant caravan, but any type of, you know, immigrant trying to, you know, seek asylum from a country that's been torn asunder by violence, usually due to U.S. policy. Obviously, the most glaring example that comes to mind is the coup in Honduras, which, of course, Hillary Clinton helped support and make happen. But in general, we tried to frame it that, you know, unless you were brought over to the U.S. on slave ships, or you were indigenous, you know, there's a good chance that you yourself, your family were immigrants at one point or another, and they probably weren't, you know, documented, which is just, you know, nonsensical thing that Trump and reactionaries like to throw around, to label immigrants as an other. So we kind of opened up with that part of it, you know, just the historical framing, and then telling soldiers that, you know, at the end of the day, you might face some repercussions or consequences, but you can say no to your orders. And the key thing in all of that is trying to do it in groups. As you know, it's obviously much harder to punish a group of soldiers who are resisting rather than individuals, which, you know, both Rory and I know from experience. And, you know, that leads, you know, Rory and I all weekend have been talking about, you know, the key thing why I bring this up is what the response was to it and why this might have happened. Now, there was a lot of positive feedback, especially among those who already share our politics, more or less. And I did receive a number of emails or other messages from veterans, some active duty soldiers who were questioning their role, whether they were being spun up to deploy to the border or not. But the thing is, there's always a reluctance and a reticence by soldiers to resist. And part of the reason why is because, you know, there's always this debate, you know, what's the current stature, what's the current nature of our anti-war movement? Some people say there isn't one to be found, others say there is, but it's not as visible. But I mean, I think both of those things speak to some kind of problem. And we have to unpack why that is.
Yeah, so another key theme of this letter was, you know, kind of putting this migrant crisis in a larger context. You can't understand what is happening at the border without understanding the history of pillage and plunder, interventions in other countries, democratically elected elections, overthrow of leadership by the U.S. over the last at least 100 years, more, 200 years. Both Spencer and I are very inspired by Eduardo Galeano's Open Veins of Latin America. This is, you know, critical reading to understanding why we're in the situation that we're at. And to turn our backs on these migrants is just unconscionable, given the fact that the U.S. is largely responsible for so many of the problems in the countries that people are fleeing right now. How many times have people tried to take control of their own natural resources only to be thwarted by the U.S. government, or try to elect a democratically elected leader only to be thwarted by the U.S. government, or how have the U.S. imposed loans on countries that basically divide the countries of these places? And we just wanted to do our best to appeal to these active duty soldiers to go up there and said, there is no way you guys can go after these people in a way that, you know, blames them for what they're doing right now. And the only thing we should be doing right now is, number one, giving back the wealth that we stole from these people so they can actually live maybe in their own country or in here, our country, wherever they want to live, because we also don't believe in borders. But, you know, we're trying to do our best to appeal to these active duty soldiers. And it obviously is not an easy thing to do because, you know, the only thing that I think is going to give people the confidence to lay their weapons down is a mass socialist movement. You know, call it, you know, free education, free healthcare. These are the things that are going to be combating U.S. imperial agendas. And so we're just hopefully planting some seeds because you got to do something on some level. And hopefully, you know, we do, you know, have some kind of impact. But anyway, it's going to take a lot more in connecting struggles and whatnot. But so maybe we can talk a little bit about our efforts to maybe counter-recruit, you know, and reaching out to young people before. I mean, the U.S. military is Just handed Chicago, this advertising firm, a $4 billion contract to appeal to young people to meet its recruiting goals. They want to have a 500,000 strong military by 2024, but they're not succeeding in this. Kids are not buying into the U.S. propaganda machine to get these kids to sign up, because they're wisening up to the fact that we're not fighting for freedom and democracy around the world. We're actually pushing back against it in many occasions. So I don't know. Maybe we can talk about some recruiting issues.
I mean, on the issue of counter recruiting, this is why electoralism is one tactic, all right? But I think there is something quite compelling, to Bernie Sanders' policy agenda. If we were to have Medicare for all, college for all, and someone who actually does stand up to the military-industrial complex on some level, I think that would give us more space for a more authentically socialist vision, because either we'll see those policies come to fruition, which would be great, or we see a reaction, either from reactionary politicians, maybe certain sections of the military, which would be quite horrifying. But at any rate, I think that would heighten the contradictions of the current era that we're in. And more importantly, I just think it would make the lives of millions of people better. And that's why we need to understand the military itself. I mean, it preys not only on that material disenfranchisement, of course, which is where everything else springs from, but there's also the sense of alienation that everyone feels. People are alienated from their labor, but they're also alienated from their humanity in some ways. And the military, it gives you a very, very strong identity. And that starts before you're even in the ranks. I mean, whether it's through a lot of the Hollywood films or certain even video games, I mean, you start to see yourself as wanting to become that proverbial badass or wanting to become that war hero. And, both Rory and I went through that on some level, but you see like what the cost is of that, both what you will do to other human beings, but what you'll do to yourself. And once you're ensnared in that system, and once you've gone through all of it, it's that much harder to pull away. And that's why you could have this grand revelation of being opposed to the wars and being opposed to what the military is doing, but it's tough to pull yourself away from it in multiple fronts. And so when it comes to counter-recruiting, I think we need to talk about just how it completely reconfigures and scrambles your brain in the way you even perceive the world into something completely different. And in the simplest sense, the longer you play the game, the harder it is to quit it. And I think that could kind of reach those who might be interested in joining the military. I mean, look, at the end of the day, if people have their minds made up, they have their minds made up. And it's tough to not kind of moralize and say, oh, you're going to be this horrible person, because that's going to turn people off. But we need to grapple with the implications of this. I do want to mention one thing. Of course, I see Bernie Sanders as the only viable candidate. But yet we still have figures like Elizabeth Warren who are trying to talk about a green military, which make people think, hey, well, maybe there's something here. Where I could be an environmental activist while also being a soldier. That doesn't exist. Most shockingly, there was this really started as a social media campaign. I think Mike Gravel, this former senator from Alaska, but it turns out that one of the kids who was running this campaign has ideations of joining their Air Force as an officer to give back to society or some nonsense like this. And he was inspired by reading John Rawls and Michael Walzer. Well, this is another. I read Walzer and Rawls at the Academy, and things like just war theory are just a long form way of justifying imperialism, an endless war. So I think you really have to, not only those who are just disenfranchised on a basic level of wanting free college, but even those who think they could kind of stay in, buy their time, and change things from the inside. It's like you need to understand how these institutions will be shaping you far more than you'll be shaping them.
Yeah, and the military sites, is one of the reasons that they're not meeting their recruiting goals. They're only at half of their targets. One of the reasons, which I think is pretty ironic, they're citing natural disasters. And they said in one of the articles in the Army Times that I read that one of our most fertile areas of recruitment is Puerto Rico. and the recruiting stations have all been destroyed in Puerto Rico because of natural disasters. Well, I think it's important to note that the U.S., I think, what's the figure? 70% of all U.S. carbon emissions is a result of the U.S. military. They're the number one polluter in the world. So I think, you know, you can't really have a strong environmental movement, a strong movement against climate destruction and global heating without it being explicitly tied to fighting U.S. imperialism. And it's just so ironic that, you know, Hurricane Maria destroys Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Army is lamenting the fact that the recruiting station is destroyed because of what they're actually doing, in part. But, you know, we also wanted to talk a little bit about, maybe we can talk about, how do we engage veterans? Is it worth reaching out to veterans, active duty soldiers? Is there a reluctance to do that? Are people uncomfortable talking to veterans or, you know, active duty soldier? How could we maybe do that? And some of that we can open up to the floor, but maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I completely understand the general reluctance to engage with active duty soldiers and veterans, because on some level I can't stand veterans or active duty soldiers either. I mean, it's a very frustrating place to be in the military, and those who buy into it, or those who play the proverbial game, it gets kind of exhausting. I mean, and then you see things like Eddie Gallagher, this murderous Navy SEAL who gets pretty completely exonerated. And obviously Trump put his finger on the scale. Trump recently pardoned a Army officer who's a war criminal who was tried in 2009. So, I mean, you see these types of things going on, and it's hard not to think that, you know, like, what's even the point? Like, it seems like so many of these people are bought in as an all-volunteer force. That being said, you know, there are plenty of soldiers who resent figures like Eddie Gallagher, that other Army war criminal, and the high-ranking officers just as much as all of us here do. And both Rory and I have experience in special operations. Now, here's the thing. He mentioned how the worst thing that could happen to you when you're in a unit like that, you know, this highly specialized, like, one percentage of soldiers who make it to these units, you know, the worst thing is you could get kicked to the big army to be a bullet stopper. Well, there's a lot more of those proverbial, you know, big army soldiers than there are any of these special operations types. And all of these highly elite units rely on supply lines and logistics. So if any of those soldiers would start to say that they've had enough of doing this, then all of those, you know, units that strike the fear into the heart of the U.S.'s proverbial enemies wouldn't really have much to stand on any longer. Because at the end of the day, it's not going to be so much of a pitched battle that defeats the U.S. military, but really affecting its logistical capabilities, just, you know, to speak on the tactical level. And that's why if you could foster some degree of class consciousness among, you know, your normal rank and file soldier, I mean, that has huge implications for the functioning of the Army and other branches of the military as a whole. So in terms of the general reluctance to engage military personnel, I mean, look, it's another field of struggle like anyone else. And if we cede that field of struggle, then you better believe that there are other political forces who are very eager to talk to those people. I mean, the year I was going through my entire spectacle, there was a Marine who was active in Atomwaffen, and, you know, the, you know, far right extremist hate group, who actually assaulted someone during Charlottesville. And I believe he was eventually, like, imprisoned for a month or something like that, and got, like, I think it either higher or the same discharge rating as myself, because obviously what we did is equivalent. But no, I mean, at the end of the day, the right wing infiltration, you know, by neo-Nazi groups of the military has been going on for quite a long time. And it's actually been on the rise in a more unique way. The Hampton Institution in 2014 conducted a study talking about the rise of Nazism, particularly in the military. I mean, there's so many examples you could point to. I mean, you have the Marine Corps Scout snipers who are posing with, you know, the Sig Roads, the SS flag, and so many other ones. So I understand why we shouldn't center, you know, U.S. military personnel. By no means am I saying that. Absolutely not. I mean, they need to understand their place when it comes to organizing. But at the end of the day, they are human beings. And I think we need to recognize that, you know, no one is beyond redemption. And I think some of the greatest revolutions of the past 100 years, for better or for worse, recognize that and see engaging with the military as a very crucial component of any radical change.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, there's so much we can talk about here, and we are just kind of running out of time. You know, I do want to just kind of maybe end on, you know, a general sense of betrayal that so many soldiers feel after they've signed up. You know, they're raised in this environment where everything military is good, you know, whether it be at baseball games or football games, and, you know, and there aren't a ton of options after graduation, so they look for ways to pay for education, they look for ways to pay for health care. But when they actually get overseas and they see what's actually going on and, you know, can sense that they're not fighting for freedom and democracy, but rather so rich people can get richer, there is this, you know, visceral sense of betrayal. They may not have these completed world views, and I do think when they come out, they're looking for direction. And I think people should engage that. You know, some of the leading anti-war people were disgruntled veterans who actually signed up during the Vietnam War. They weren't necessarily drafted, but they actually signed up but felt betrayed by the genocide, by the mass murder that was happening in Vietnam at the time. And I think the same dynamic exists here in the United States. You know, since, you know, 2001 to 2012, another number, there was 40,000 war resistors in this country alone. And that number has gone up since then. Those people are out there, and we just need to make the space like this where we can open up and say, yeah, you know what, if you do decide to resist, you know, we're going to welcome you in, and there is going to be a support network, and we're also going to be fighting for free education, free health care, all these things, so you actually don't have to sign up in the first place, you know, to go to that point. And that is a great, great way to challenge U.S. imperialism, is just by fighting for those things. So again, so much to talk about. Hopefully you can kind of bring some of this stuff out in the discussion. Thanks again for having us. We really appreciate the opportunity.